You, I believe, you taught at Ohio University for a quarter, didn't you?
I was writer in residue there for one quarter.
Writer in residue. I was talking to Duane Schneider, who is the chairman of the English department today, and he was not there when you were teaching, but he told me to tell you that you were well liked.
Thank you. I had a good time. My wife says it was the happiest time of our marriage. We're not married anymore, but it was a good time. Front porch, apple, fresh apples, Appalachia, nice environment.
When were you there?
It was about 72, I think.
Well, I'm on the alumni board of directors of Ohio University, and one of the things that I have proposed at Ohio University, and I'm trying to spearhead it, launch it, is to create a permanent visiting writer program there.
They had an embryo program. They had that fellow, what's his name, who wrote Charlie, wrote Flowers for Algernon.
Now he's still there, Dan Keyes.
And poor Walter Tevis, who just died, I lived in his house. I became friendly. I didn't know him there. I had sublet his house. But I got to know him later, and I saw him in June here when, in fact, CBS was doing a film of a story of mine, and said goodbye to him. He's dying then.
Yeah. Now, I believe it was last March, I staged a small reading for some Ohio University people here in New York, and Walter was here. I've had Walter in here twice, and we talked.
He's a good writer.
As his books came out, he was a very good writer, and so he gave a reading. And Jack Matthews, did you meet him on
sure.
the campus?
Sure, I hear from him now and then. In fact, he's put me in some anthologies he's done, and we're, you know, kind of pen pals, like once every 2 years. He collected owls, do you remember that? His wife collected owls. I think I sent him an owl once that I got in Haiti.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Hollis Summers was there too. Did you meet him?
Not so well. I knew him slightly.
He, believe it or not, I had dinner with him when I was in on the campus last month, and he didn't remember me. But he was my creative writing professor in 1956. Of course, I was just a skinny kid who didn't write very well, and I'm sure that.
That's not uncommon.
Easily forgettable.
When I was invited to teach at Stanford in the Stegner, that graduate writing program by Wally Stegner, I reminded him, of course he didn't remember, that I'd been rejected for the program some years before, 20 years as a student. I'd been rejected, but I was asked to run the program.
Doesn't that make you feel good?
It was fun. Yeah, he looked, it can happen. Why not? Some of my worst students have become successful writers. And some of the ones that I thought were great haven't made it. And it doesn't mean I was wrong. It just means the public's needs are not what I value. I had a really rotten young woman student who's written two successful books. Of course, I'm not going to name her. I had a student at Stanford who was the least good in the class. He was glib. He's become a very successful writer. I defended him against the other students who thought he was just showboater. And he paid me back by reviewing me in the New York Times as badly as I've ever been reviewed.
Oh, well, that hurts.
The classic. Well,
how come, here you list your credits here, you say you lecture at Harvard, Cornell, Stanford, University of California, and you don't list Ohio?
I didn't actually teach there. I was just appeared there. They had must have had some money that year to have. I didn't teach.
Mm-hmm.
I was just living there. And I'm not even, I guess it was a whole quarter, but it was a relatively short period of time.
Well, what happens occasionally, somebody will quit, on the faculty will quit, and they have some money left over in the budget. And so they can use that. So
yeah,
they
have
occasionally brought in a few visiting writers because of the surplus funds. But
I still have a tooth that was fixed by the dentist in Athens who gave me, it was who I remember very well, a lovely fellow. We became friends. I used to ride Walter Tevis's bike to get my tooth treated. And when I left, he gave me a knife. He was a hobbyist, and he'd made a knife, and he'd drawn a picture, etched a picture of my tooth on the blade. And I sent him from San Francisco a yogurt maker, and he said, "What the hell is that?" Didn't know what yogurt was.
In southeastern Ohio? Of course not. Well, you are now in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've lived there 25 years.
And you are teaching there?
No, I'm not teaching. I teach now and then, but I'm writing my books, and I do some magazine writing.
Mm-hmm.
I do quite a lot of magazine writing, actually.
Boy, you're really turning them out, too.
Well, the day is long.
Got to do something to fill up the time. I really enjoyed Fathers a lot. You wrote that, I believe, in 1966, didn't you?
Right. It's just been reissued, as I guess. I think you have the new edition.
Yeah.
Remember Huss did.
Yeah. Well, a lot of your childhood is, of course, found in Fathers. Perhaps, because I'd like to do a profile of you, and I'd like to hear it from your own words, perhaps you could tell me a little bit about yourself. Of course, we know that you were born in Cleveland, and we know a lot about Sandgold by reading Fathers. But tell me a little bit about yourself and your childhood and your background.
I grew up in Cleveland. Actually, I didn't. I grew up in Lakewood, which is a far west suburb of Cleveland. I was different from the other kids because of two things which I had to discover gradually. One, that I was a Jew, the only Jew I knew, and the other was that I wanted to be a writer. There were others who wanted to do that. I had some good friends, Bob Berryman, Ted Brown, Richard Merway, others who wanted to do that. But I had to, so my childhood was a process of defining myself in these two areas, and to some extent they came together. I grew up in the time when the German-American Bund, the Black Legion, the Silver Shirts were throwing leaflets on doors. I remember once having the measles and an open can of fish was thrown through the window. And there was a lot of that kind of nonsense, which people don't even understand about anymore. And it toughened me in some way and also made me aware of my environment in a special way. I still have very friendly memories of Lakewood. I still hear from and of Lakewood High School. I heard a few months ago from my old journalism teacher, who I guess he won't resent it if I call him old now. He's retired and living in Florida, Seymour Slater, whom I dedicated a book to. And around the same time, I heard from my fifth grade teacher, who Ruth Collins at Taft School, who told me, she didn't tell me I should be a writer. But we had to write a composition every Friday, and I was standing in line at the water fountain, and I'd written a story about a snake, and she came and said she'd read my story, and she put her hand on my head, and that was such a wonderful feeling, her hand on my head, that I realized I could find what Scott Fitzgerald said, the love of beautiful women by writing, and it really, I think, traumatized me in a friendly way forever. Then I remember she said I misspelled gruesome. It was not spelled G-R-E-W, but G-R-U-E.
It is? Well, how old were you then?
Well, that was fifth grade.
Fifth grade.
But I had always written poetry and stories. I had a brother nearly my age, and we slept in the same room with twin beds, and we told each other stories every night. We took turns, so four times a week, I told him the story, and it really got me into the habit of telling stories and liking to hear stories.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Columbia. That was partly because of growing up in Cleveland. My parents thought, naturally, as the oldest son, I should either be a doctor or a lawyer. But I wanted to be a philosopher or a writer or a poet or all three of those things. They said, well, you'll go to Western Reserve University. They have a wonderful medical school. I said, no, I want to go to Columbia. They have Mark Van Doren teaching poetry and Irwin Edmund teaching philosophy. And we fought back and forth about that, and I won't say I won, but I did go to Columbia against their better judgment. And then, fortunately for me, the war happened, and I went off to the war, and so the GI Bill sent me through school. I started a few months at Columbia, then part of my freshman year, then went to the war.
You have a wonderful episode in Fathers about your grudge match with the redneck Fletcher. I don't know if he's a redneck. I can't remember if he's a redneck, but he certainly was an anti-Semite, and there was a wonderful chapter about that. You were 18, I guess, and you wore those 16, 18-pound boxing gloves.
We knocked each other out by lifting, by swinging the gloves. I try to tell my children about that. I have young children, young half-Jewish children. They literally cannot understand it. It's so out of their experience. It's just something that doesn't happen these days in anything like that way. I'm sure it doesn't even happen in the Army. I visited a battleship in the, or a big aircraft carrier in San Francisco Bay a few days ago and saw all the black seamen. I mean, that was so strange when remembering my military experience where you stared at the black soldiers and they were engineers. They did menial job. It was a different world, a different Army, different America.
You went back to Columbia after the service?
Went back to Columbia, got a bachelor's degree, then got a master's degree in philosophy, then went got a Fulbright and went to Paris for a couple of years to supposedly to write a doctoral dissertation in philosophy, but bought a bicycle and found it was much easier to write a novel than to write philosophy on a bicycle, and sat in cafes through a couple of cold winters and wrote a novel.
Tell me about that novel.
It's the first thing to say about it, it's not very good. It's called Birth of a Hero. It was published and was a wonderful thing for me to happen to me because it made me think of, it enabled me to say I was a writer. I left Paris when it was accepted by Viking Press. It even got some good reviews. Came back to Cleveland expecting to buy the 3-cent stamp with my picture on it in the Lakewood Post Office. Of course, that didn't happen. But I now could say I was a writer. I was a published novelist with a good publisher.
What year was that?
1951. And I was young. I had a new baby and another one on the way. I worked in Cleveland for a while as a night clerk in a hotel and as the editor of an entertainment magazine and stayed up all night listening to rock and roll, what wasn't called rock and roll then, wrote a whole series of stories about disc jockeys, got fascinated by disc jockeys, by Alan Freed, and who later became famous. I became friendly with a couple of them, Bill Gordon, particularly, there was another one named Bill Randall.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote these stories because I liked telling stories. Nobody was going to print funny stories about disc jockeys. A few years later, it was like a miracle. Playboy was born. And all those stories suddenly were acceptable, and people could understand how I wrote them so fast. They'd been piled up in a drawer, and so Playboy and my stories about disc jockeys financed the end of my first marriage.
And Alan Freed, of course, he drank himself to death.
But he was a strange and wonderful character to come out of Cleveland.
Yeah, he got involved in a lot of payola, and I guess all those disc jockeys.
Oh, yeah, he was in a world where a lot of people did what he did. He did more of it than they did because he was famouser and more powerful. He was just a crazy white lover of black music, and he really changed history.
Well, Herbert Gold, the hero of your latest novel, Mr. White Eyes, is a news correspondent. And, of course, you have also been a news correspondent somewhere along your career. How did that happen?
If you're a novelist and all you do is write about your love life and your family life and your parents, you are exhausted by midlife, and it's a real problem for a lot of American writers. The first novel is about how your parents didn't understand you, your second novel is about how your first wife didn't understand you, and then your third novel gets very boring. So I made a decision early that I was going to do other things, drive a cab, anything. And being a journalist attracted me. You see the world, you find out about things. And so as it happens, I've been in a number of wars. I covered war in Biafra for Harper's, and I wrote a little book about Biafra. I covered both the 1967, the Six-Day War and the October War in Israel. And I've been to Haiti to cover revolutions that didn't happen, which is one of the themes of this book. And I've done a lot of journalism, and I like it. But
who were you working for, or were you?
It's all been as a freelance. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I have done a lot for the New York Times. Did stories about Haiti, let's say, for the New York Times Magazine. I've done other things. I did a story, I've done stories about Indians and different things for the New York Times Magazine over the years. And I've also had things syndicated by the L.A. Times. I've done things for the L.A. Times and for the San Francisco Chronicle. And they've also have a limping syndicate. But most of the work has been done for magazines and, I mean, for magazines. Playboy, Harper's, The Atlantic. We were talking about Ohio University. I did an article about what education is like in southeastern Ohio at a university called Ohio University. It was either Harper's or The Atlantic. Someone said there should be a magazine called either Harper's or The Atlantic. and I can't remember which one it was now.
That's funny. Well, you... all during this period, of course, as you were doing your journalism, you were also writing books. You have a lot of them to your credit. And teaching. So you've certainly had a mixed career, haven't you?
It's something I've chosen to do. And I now in middle life, I know a lot of writers who are burnt out, or having trouble finding new things to do, or de-energized or exhausted. Have said everything they've had to say. I feel I'm learning. I learn through teaching. I learn through journalism. I learn through my family. But I will never sit in a cork-lined room. That was great for Proust, but it's just not the way I perceive the world.
We were talking about Walter Tevis a while ago, and Tevis told me that he had a theory that a writer keeps writing the same book over and over, and the trick is to disguise it. Do you agree with that?
There's an element in that, which is, someone else said the writer learns everything he's going to learn before he's 25, and then after that he explores it. There's an element of autobiography in everything you do. Every book is autobiographical, including your bank book, or especially your bank book. But you're also, the word novel means news. You're also bringing news of the world. And even if your perceptions remain consistent, and I hope my books, even Birth of a Hero, the one I don't like, has something consistent with with Mr. White Eyes, my newest baby, which I do like. There's a metabolism that's operating that's consistent. There's some kind of sense of prose and some kind of sensibility. But you bring in the news, and the news is what you know, what you experience. And if you don't stop learning, you don't stop knowing. Walter Tevis he liked people who went up against tasks. He not only wrote a good book, a wonderful book about pool players, he wrote a wonderful book about a girl chess player. So there is something consistent, but there's something very different. I mean, chess... a girl chess player is very different from an old pool shark. And I've written about my love of my mother and father and family, and I've also written about my love of long, slim California girls. I think the thing that is consistent is the love there.
You went back to Cleveland after publishing your first novel of The Viking and did a variety of jobs there, but at some point you decided to go to San Francisco. Why did you make that move?
I wandered the world a good deal. I lived in after I left Cleveland, for one thing I spent years on the road, but then I lived in New York, I lived in Paris, and I lived in Haiti. And I was back living in New York in the late 50s and found, and at that time my career was going quite well, I can say that reasonably modestly. I was young, considered to be young, and was put quotation marks around it, promising. But I found it made me very nervous to be a young and promising writer in New York. There was too much attention. Every day there was something going on that distracted from writing. A telephone call from a producer, a Voice of America broadcast, an interview, a publisher's party. It was very hard to write, and people, it seemed to me this was a recipe for being burned out. Then I was offered I'd written a story called Love and Like, and there had been some theatrical interest in it, and I'd written a play version of it. And the Ford Foundation, since I spoke French, wanted to send me to a theater in France that was going to do the play, but I had young children and I didn't want to leave the States for a year without them. And there was a very good theater then in San Francisco called the Actors Workshop. So they, with a Ford Foundation grant, sent me to San Francisco supposedly to do that play. And I sublet my apartment on Waverly Place in New York. Within 2 weeks, I called my tenant and said, you can keep it. And I still have lamps and I think even clothes in the closet on Waverly Place.
Should have kept that apartment. You know how much it's
worth. It was very small.
It doesn't make any difference. I was talking to Alice Adams a while back, I guess just last month or so. She lives in San Francisco. And she said one of the things that she likes about San Francisco is the absence of a literary community. But actually, there are an awful lot of... Whether Diane Johnson is there...
Well, there are a lot of writers, and what she said is correct. There are a lot of writers. There is no literary community to speak of. I know Alice Adams. I never see her. I mean, I see her in passing. I see her sometimes in a restaurant. But I can say proudly, I've never been to dinner at her house, nor has she been to mine. Once in a while we meet, but it's really in passing. What makes a literary community is not writers, it's people who invite them. it's those little canapes that make a literary community, and the writers don't make them. It's the agents and the publishers and the editors and the broadcasters and the Voice of America.
I have a feeling that a lot of writers paddle around a lot in the New York area. Styron, for example, is in the center of a lot of social activity among writers.
When I was here, that was one of the dangers. All my friends were writers. Even my doctor was a writer's doctor. If I had to have my throat looked at, it was a man who just looked at Bill Styron's throat. And I knew him, and I had nothing against him. I liked him. But it's not good for writing to only know other writers. I have some good friends in San Francisco who are writers, but we meet not to talk about publishing business because there isn't anything to do there. We can't gossip about our agents and our editors because we never see them. So I meet one to play racquetball. I meet another one because we like to walk a lot and we're old friends since childhood. I happen to see Diane Johnson now and then, and I like her very much and like her work, but we taught together at the University of California at Davis, and I don't see her all that often, although she lives only a couple of blocks from me. So there are a few cafes where you can go and see other writers.
Oh, that should be fun. Well, you know, just like clockwork, every week our syndication unit send a book beat out to KCBS in San Francisco, and like clockwork, they never use it, but they get it there. And I do a lot of San Francisco writers. You had a royalty dispute that led to the courtroom battle, didn't you?
You're really you've done your homework. I had a big fight with my former publisher, Random House. It was a contract dispute, very complicated. I have to say I won. I'm not litigious. I did not want to go to court. They sued me. I had to countersue, and I won. A very ugly story, and it has to do with the bookkeepers and the accountants taking over and the conglomerates taking over the business. I have not very friendly feelings about a few people that were involved, but that's all over.
That's too bad things like that happen. I have a feeling that writers are a vulnerable lot. And Dan Keyes was telling me about the dispute he had had over Flowers for Algernon, and Cliff Robertson was trying to stop it from being transformed into a Broadway play. And Dan has felt ripped off and was underpaid. And you see a writer, and I'm very sympathetic to writers, and I have been for many, many years, as a failed writer myself, and I see the struggle that a writer has in order to transform his ideas and his thoughts to paper, and to see a writer being exploited, it's an outrage when you think about it.
I remember Dan telling me very funny stories about Cliff Robertson and the manuscript for that book when he was doing it. Everybody has these horror stories, and it's a good thing to get away from because it's really distracting. It's counterproductive to the kind of contemplativeness and the deep. You can have deep rages. The rages against publishers are basically trivial rages. I wrote a piece, it was in The Atlantic, called about the paranoia that writers have when their books are published. It's called I Wrote a Book Disease. It's when the whole world is conspiring to prevent your book, Mr. White Eyes, from being as famous as it's supposed to be. Writers do get caught. There's a paranoid tendency, and it's part of Western civilization, urban civilization, to get paranoid. And here, writers are not businesses. They don't have in-house lawyers. It's easy to get down on them. And in my case, I think my living in California was part of the problem. The Random House thought that I was defenseless because they had all the law and the lawyers, and I had to come to New York to fight it, and they were surprised that I fought back.
You know, A.E. Hotchner, he had
a... the same thing with Random House.
Against Random House, right. And he also won it. Well, he didn't really win it. He settled out of court.
Yeah, but I've read... But
they didn't know that he happened to have had a law degree.
Right. I must say, I followed his case with a lot of sympathy.
Well, I do hope that Mr. White Eyes becomes a famous novel. You're a wonderful, wonderful writer. To wrap things up, can you kind of outline how you work as a writer and what your style is as you put words to paper?
It's hard to describe. I use clay tablets and a stylus normally, not a word processor. To me, writing has become almost metabolic. I have to do it. I have nightmares if I don't. I need to tell stories. And so I write on the backs of menus, I write on paper, I write with typewriter, pencil, pen, I can write on planes, I write, I usually write in the morning, that's the best time, but if I'm really going, I'll get waked in the middle of the night by my own dreams. I have very little procedures. It's very much like asking me how I breathe, I just do it.
Do you have a very fixed schedule for yourself in addition to all of the note-taking and everything that you do?
No, I used to. I used to make a rule to do it in the morning, and I still try to do it in the morning, but it's not anymore a rule. And I used to, when I first started writing, I would try to say I'll write 4 pages every day, or I'll write for an hour or two every day. When I was working as a night clerk, I had a 54-hour-a-week shift. Nevertheless, I got the work done in the middle of the night on Prospect Avenue in Cleveland when the drunks were calling for ice and the girls were calling to have the drunks thrown out of their rooms. I was still writing at the switchboard. But it's become a part of my survival. I can't not write. I used to say to my former wife, stop me before I write more.
You said you had young children. Are they a distraction? Do you have a quiet place in your house? You write in your
home? I have a quiet place. I get away from them. When I was married and lived with them, I had a separate place where I went to work. When I lived in one room with my wife and first child, I used to write in cafes then. When I didn't have a place separate from my children, I would go out and write in anything, an ice cream parlor, a library, a park bench, whatever.
Well, I would assume that you're already embarking on a new novel then, or a new something.
I have something. I have a new something secretly in my head.
Well, Herbert Gold, as I said, you're a wonderful writer. I thank you very much for coming in and talking to me, and I wish the hell I could get BookBeat on KCPS in San Francisco so you could hear it out there.
So do I.
Well, it's heard it in KNX in Los Angeles, so that's any consolation. But thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks very much.